what you're saying is everything is society's fault and we as individuals never need to take responsibility for anything.
No, not exactly. I was just saying
that... I like that. I didn't do anything wrong because I can't do anything wrong. Because we're all just products of our environment, bouncing around like marbles in the game of Hungry Hungry Hippos that is our random and cruel universe.
That's a clip from the hit animated Netflix series BoJack Horseman. It's the story of a washed-up, depressed sitcom star in his 50s, who also happens to be a horse. Raphael Bob Waksberg is the creator of BoJack Horseman, and he's also the author of a short story collection called Someone Who Will Love You in All Your Damaged Glory. Like BoJack, Raphael's stories find a great balance of melancholy and humanity and love.
I have a poem in my new book that is a story about a guy who writes a poem for a girl he's dating. And that was also based on a different experience, actually, where I wrote a poem for a girl and it felt inappropriate, I'll say. It was more for me than it was for her.
I see.
And as soon as I gave it to her, that kind of became clear, and it was very uncomfortable. And so the poem in the book is a heavily fictionalized version of that event.
I see. Would you mind reading an excerpt from the poem?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'm more than a little ambivalent over expressions of tender devotion. This one day a year because greeting card companies profit off store-bought emotion. A romance industrial complex so fueled by commodification of feeling serves only to further homogenize all and promote what's at best unrevealing. It's not just a lack of precision, this one-size-fits-allness that leads me to mope. I think you and I share the same disillusionment sprouted from long-buried hope. I worry, as you do, love dulls us to cold hollow sockets that ache for a joint. If ends are encoded in every beginning, we wonder, then what is the point? You're right to be highly suspicious of seemingly mandated acts of affection when all pretty words are a means to an ultimate heartbreak, a grand misdirection. I can't guarantee that this letter won't lead to us both one day broken and blue. All that being said, though, you turn me to mush. Happy Valentine's, Wendy, to you. As Wendy regarded the card she received with a coolness that trended toward frozen, Fernando now briefly considered he'd gone a bit wrong with the words he had chosen. He'd wanted to offer assurance to Wendy that all her concerns were well-founded, while also affirming he wasn't afraid of the many alarm bells she'd sounded. "Hey, don't fall in love with me," Wendy had said, and Fernando insisted, "I'm not." He thought he had threaded the needle quite well, but it seemed not as well as he'd thought. "You turn me to mush" was perhaps a bit much. Yes, in hindsight, his error was here. The poem's detachment undone in an instant by something so baldly sincere.
That was great. Thank you. I love that surprise that you create with this pivot in the fourth stanza, because it starts out as a poem, but then it pivots to a short story about the writing of the poem.
Right, while continuing to be a poem.
Exactly. Did you have this idea from the very beginning, or did that kind of come up while you were writing it?
Yeah, well, it started as the poem itself, and then I kept thinking about what this poem was and what it meant and represented. And the story kind of flowed from there and continued. I mean, one thing I try to do in all my stories is justify the form with the content. So a lot of times I'll think of the form first of like, oh, I want to tell a story like this or in this kind of style. I really wanted to do a story in verse. You know, I'm a big fan of David Rakoff's book, Love, Dishonor, Marry, Die, Cherish, Perish, which is an entire book written in verse. And I always enjoy writing little poems and here and there. And so I thought, could I write a whole story that was a poem? And so then I thought, well, what would justify a story being a poem? And then I thought, well, if it's about a poem, that feels like a good place to start.
Yeah, for sure. You've got kind of a Marshall McLuhan medium is the message thing going on there.
Right, exactly.
Back in 2010, when you first came up with the idea for BoJack Horseman, you wrote that you envisioned the tone of the show as darkly funny with a melancholy Great Gatsby-ish center. Would you say that this description fits your short story collection?
Yes, I think that's true. I think that depending on your own emotional constitution, you might find the stories in this book to be very funny, or you might find them to be very sad. And I've seen both that reaction, which I think is very interesting, that they are, I think, funny mostly, but there's a dark comedy to them, and there certainly is a melancholy center to a lot of them.
Yeah, which also reminds me of the new review of your book. The AV Club describes you as one of the most consistent and efficient purveyors of transcendent tragic comedy. Do you think of your work as tragic comic? It sounds like you do.
I guess so. Yeah. I don't know if I'd call it transcendent, but I'm very flattered to be described in those terms.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that tragedy and comedy, that's life, right? It's all kind of funny and sad, and the way we muddle through it can be inspiring and devastating and hilarious and stupid. And I kind of want to track that gamut in my work. I think that real life has all of those modes. It's a sweet and salty mix of all of it. And that's something that I definitely try to convey in my work.
Yeah, which you do very well, I think. Let's talk a bit about the story, A Most Blessed and Auspicious Occasion. Can you tell me a bit about this one without revealing any spoilers?
Sure. This story is maybe one of the more autobiographical in the book.
Really?
Well, it's based on my wedding, mm-hmm. Although very loosely based. You know, when my wife and I decided to get married, we decided early on we wanted to keep it very small and very simple. And I was really continually shocked in the planning of the wedding, how even trying to keep it small and simple, how it became quite an ordeal. And, you know, how all the people we had to please and all the things we had to do. Also to please ourselves based on our own expectations of what a wedding was and needed to be. And how even this very small version of it ended up being quite overwhelming, but in the end, quite beautiful as well.
Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt.
Sure. "Really, the only thing stressing me out is the goats thing," says Dorothy. "Once we figure out what to do with the goats, everything else falls into place. All of a sudden, I have a crazy idea. So crazy, I feel like I can't even say it out loud. But as soon as it worms its way into my head, I feel like I can't not say it. So I blurt out, 'You want to just not sacrifice any goats?' Dorothy is silent for a moment. And I know that as soon as I stop the car, she's going to get out and run away and never talk to me again. And the next time I see her is going to be in a photo on the cover of a trashy tabloid at the checkout line with the headline, 'My fiancé didn't want to sacrifice goats.' But instead, Dorothy says, 'Can we do that?' And I say, 'Dorothy, it's our wedding. We can do whatever we want.' She smiles, and I feel like how Clark Kent must feel when he overhears someone talking about Superman. But doing whatever we want turns out to be a real headache when we're applying for our marriage license. 'How many goats are you going to sacrifice to the stone god?' asks the woman at window 5. 'We're not going to sacrifice any goats to the stone god,' I say proudly. 'It's not that kind of wedding.' The woman looks down at her form and then back up at us. 'So, just like 5 then?' 'No,' says Dorothy. 0. The man behind us in line groans and makes a big show out of looking at his watch. 'I don't understand,' says the woman. 'You mean like 1 or 2? The stone god is not going to like getting so few goats.' 'No,' I say. 'Not 1 or 2. 0. We are sacrificing 0 goats to the stone god.' She crinkles up her nose. 'Well, there's not an option on the form for 0, so I'm just going to put you down for 5. Next thing I know, we get a visit from Dorothy's best friend, Nikki. 'I heard you're only going to sacrifice 5 goats.' 'No,' I start to say, but she cuts me off. 'If you don't sacrifice at least 38 goats, my mom's not going to come. You know she's a traditionalist about this sort of thing.'"
That was awesome. Great energy, flow and pace in your reading, and I love the voice of the woman.
Thank you.
So you mentioned that this story is loosely based on your own wedding, but—
Very loosely.
Very loosely, because there were no goats sacrificed.
Yes, I want to be very clear. There were no goats sacrificed at our wedding.
So it seems to me like you're really taking on the wedding industrial complex with this story about how they try and monetize a wedding and, you know, that the more money you spend, the more happy right. and successful your wedding is going to be. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the wedding industry, but there's also the wedding culture. You know, it's so ingrained in kind of the what we imagined for ourselves ever since we were little kids of what our wedding would be like and what the perfect wedding is and what it means and what it represents. I think that means something a little different to everybody, but it's all kind of wrapped around this cultural ideal based on the culture that we swim in.
Yeah. So did you have a big wedding?
No, we still kept it pretty small. But even keeping it small, there were a lot of decisions to be made and a lot of things that we wanted to be just perfect.
I want to ask you about the story Rufus, or Rufus is how it should be pronounced, right? Is that what that why it's written that way with
yes.
the big letters at the end? Yeah, Rufus.
Yes.
So this story is told entirely from the point of view of a dog named Rufus. What inspired you to write this story?
I was walking my dog, which I got when I married my wife. She came with a dog. And I'd never really been a pet person before this. I didn't have pets growing up. I never really got dogs, I'll say. My friends would have dogs, and it kind of became a running joke with my friends that I was very uncomfortable around them or didn't quite know how to be around them or how to treat them. And then I started taking care of first my girlfriend's dog, and then it became my wife's dog. And now he's my dog as well. And I really fell in love with him and became delighted by him. And I was really fascinated in his understanding of me and my role in his life. And I felt like a lot of the fictional representations of dogs I'd seen had either been very stupid or all-knowing, kind of like, oh, you know, my master doesn't understand that he's in love with this person, but I'm going to, you know, wrap my leash around them and get them together or whatever. And I felt like neither was quite true of my dog. And I felt like my dog was very smart, but just his context was completely different than mine. And I tried to imagine what the world would look like through my dog's understanding of it. And that was kind of the beginning of Rufus.
Could you read the opening from Rufus for us?
Sure. Rufus is a noise that has many meanings. Sometimes, when man-monster makes noise like Rufus, what it means is, come here. Sometimes, Rufus means, I am currently petting your head. Sometimes, Rufus means, I am happy to see you. And sometimes it means, I am very upset. I have discerned many meanings of noise Rufus. I am very smart. Occasionally, man-monster is making noises with other man-monster, and in middle of many annoying nonsense noises, man-monster will make noise Rufus, and I will look at man-monster like, why did you make noise Rufus? And man-monster will see me looking and will laugh. I do not know why this delights man-monster so, but I am happy to delight. Man-monster makes many noises, and part of my job as companion to man-monster is to decipher noises and discern meanings. At first, I did not care to discern meanings of man-monster noises, because why should I bother? I am creature with rich interior life. I should waste time trying to discern meanings of grunts and whines from man-monster? But now I see that man-monster is very unable to discern meanings of my noises, so if we are to understand each other at all, I am the one who must discern meanings. And since we live in same house, it is better for everyone if someone understands someone. So, fine. We are companions, and I discern meanings. Here is example. When man-monster is upset, man-monster makes noise like, bad dog! This is worst noise man-monster can make. Bad dog is for when universe conspires to make life miserable, and one is without hope. Many times, man-monster is very frustrated at situation, and makes bad dog at me, like is my fault universe is unfair. This is very frightening for me to see man-monster agitated so, when I am so small. But I know man-monster is foolish beast, and does not know is not my fault for bad dog.
That was great. I love how you said bad dog. Bad dog! Back in 2010, when you first came up with the idea for BoJack Horseman, you described BoJack as insufferably self-deprecating, neurotic, abrasive, and stubborn. Larry David meets Bender from Futurama. I love that description. I'm wondering, is there a particular character that you can point to in your book as being the most like BoJack?
I don't think my characters in the book are like BoJack at all very much. You know, I think I really kind of got my BoJack kicks out on the show. And I was interested in exploring other worlds in the books, although I will say there is a strain of melancholy that kind of, you know, lives in the veins of BoJack, the current of his life.
You're a millionaire movie star with a girlfriend who loves you, acting in your dream movie. What more do you want? What else could the universe possibly owe you?
I want to feel good about myself, the way you do. And I don't know how.
And I think that strain of melancholy certainly exists in a lot of the characters in the book. There's a story called Move Across the Country, which is about a character trying to outpace their own depression by picking up their roots and moving around. And I think that is very BoJack-y, that idea of I'm miserable here, but maybe if I go somewhere else, I can be less miserable. And that misery kind of following you. So I certainly think there's a strain of BoJack that kind of pervades a lot of these.
Raphael Bob Waksberg is the creator of the animated Netflix series BoJack Horseman. He's also the author of the short story collection, Someone Who Will Love You in All Your Damaged Glory. You can find out more about Raphael at wpr.org/beta.
Because Tribe was using these instrumental bass lines that were really heavy and deep and bottomed out, that also sounded good in the car.
Critic Hanif Abdurraqib on the low-end musical magic of A Tribe Called Quest. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.